Thank you for joining us again for another informative episode of Satellite Nation. Satellite Nation is a weekly call-in show geared towards the hobby side of all things television. Brought to you by Satellite Guys Radio. Now here are your hosts, Michael and Brian.
Good evening, Satellite Nation. I'm Brian Gohl, a.k.a. Titanium Satellite. Now, I took a little time off this week to spend time with family and then also work the elections yesterday. So Michael's put together a great interview with Peter Barrett. He's the co-host over at Amateur Logic. So if you want to check out a great technology show, you're into technology, building projects, etc., check out Amateur Logic. Now, before we get over to that interview, I want to thank Scott over at SatelliteGuys.us. Great forums if you're into technology. Also, Dave over at Got C-Band. He helps us out by putting us on an audio server, getting us up on Galaxy 19 satellite on the KU band side. And then also Ralph Black over at Access America. He and Mike Cole have a show right after ours at 9 p.m. Eastern on Wednesday evenings, and that's called Sat Talk Radio. And so that's on Access America and also heard on Satellite Guys Radio. Now, if you happen to miss a Satellite Nation show, you can always catch us on a playback on satelliteguys.us. Remember to like us on Facebook at facebook.com/Satellite Nation Radio or follow us on Twitter at SatNatRadio. Let's get into that interview.
Good evening, Satellite Nation, and welcome to another very informative interview. Now, if you'll recall, last week on the show, we had George Thomas from Amateur Logic TV. Now, George doesn't just do the show by himself. He also has on the show with him two co-hosts. One is Tommy, and Tommy's right down in Mississippi with him. And the other is Peter, and Peter video Skypes in all the way down from Australia. So I thought, hey, it'd be kind of interesting to get Peter on the show. See how things are in Australia, because things down there are a little bit different than what they are up here. So I got up with Peter, looked him up, and he said sure he'd do the show. Did a little research on him. Peter is a computer programmer, is a hobby on the side, dabbles in electronics, likes to play with satellite equipment like we do. So I said, hey, let's bring on Peter. And so we got together, sat down, and so Peter, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon, Michael. It's a pleasure to be on, and I'm quite humbled to be asked. Thank you.
You're quite welcome, and I'm just appreciate you being on and taking your time out to be with us here. And how did a guy from Australia end up being on a show over in the U.S. for Amateur Logic TV?
During my day job, I'm an accountant working for the government here in Australia, and I occasionally went interstate, and I'm also an amateur TV operator, and what had happened was I'd gotten interested in amateur television, and having put together the equipment to actually transmit material, I actually needed some material to transmit. So I went around and was hunting around the internet trying to find stuff that would fit within the regulations. In other words, had an electronics or amateur radio component to
right.
it. And, you know, I came across this show called Amateur Logic, and I thought, oh, this is pretty good. There were 12 episodes at the time, and the show had gone into a hiatus. In other words, they burnt themselves out.
Yeah.
And at that stage, it was George, Tommy, and Jimmy
yeah.
had done these episodes. And yeah, they were, even at that stage, very professionally produced. All the hosts were very entertaining, and the material was, you know, on point. It wasn't totally on amateur radio, but it was sufficiently sufficiently of the right kind that I would be able to transmit it through amateur TV here in Australia.
Right.
So what I did was I loaded up all these old programs on my laptop, and as I said, I was going interstate, and I watched them, and thought, oh, gee, this is really good. And earlier on, going back many, many years to when I was in high school, I actually did a video for my when I was in year 12, or what we called HSC then, high school certificate, the last year of secondary college, and I did a video about the school with a friend. And apparently that video got used for many, many years. I wish I could get a copy of it now, in fact. And but that was the only time I ever got to do any video. And I thought, well, you know, this is I enjoyed it. It was a lot of fun. And so when I was watching George and Tommy, I thought, well, you know, maybe I could make a contribution here somehow. Right. I didn't have a video camera at the time. You know, I hadn't played with video editing. I hadn't done anything in this space at all. But I got in contact with George through Echolink.
Okay.
And got to chatting with them and finding out what they were doing. And I was talking about options about, well, how could I possibly do a video? Because they were asking for people to make video submissions.
Right, yeah.
And I had at the time, I thought at the time, well, maybe I could use something like a webcam with a laptop and put together something. And I sort of looked at the results and quality of webcams at the time and thought, ultimately, no. So I decided to splurge a little bit, and I went out and bought myself a 3CCD camera from Panasonic, which is similar to what the guys were using over in the US. And I went down and shot some footage of a local hamfest, the Moorabbin Districts Radio Club Hamfest here in Australia. That was 9 years ago. Oh, sorry, 7 years ago.
Right.
And uploaded the footage to George, who went and edited it. I did a little bit of editing first, but he did, polished it off a little bit.
Right.
And the next thing they know, they said, well, look, we'd like to invite you on the program. And so they set it up so that I would come in via Skype video,
right.
And they would have me on a TV in the background. And so I thought, all right, fine, and we shot that, and everything went well. Now, again, this was they'd been in a hiatus for 6 months, and so they produced their 13th episode with myself. And so I thought, oh, that was fun. I enjoyed doing that. And the next thing they know, they ask me, well, okay, what are you doing next month? And I went, what?
Let's do this again.
All right, so I thought, well, you know, why not? I've got a camera, may as well put it to some use. So basically it's just rolled on from there, and I've continued to make contributions in a number of areas to the show, putting a segment together, doing a bit of hosting. I also helped establish the Roku channel. Because I actually had a Roku at home, and I thought, well, gee, it'd be nice if I could just watch the videos, because I like to watch them at a later stage,
right.
If I could just watch them on my Roku. So I set up my own Roku channel, and that was a private channel. In other words, it's not available through what we call the channel store,
right.
But if you knew the code, you could specially get access to these videos. And
upload them to somewhere, or is that feeding off your computer at the house when somebody accesses that?
No, it actually feeds off the same database of files that you download from if you go to our website.
Oh, okay.
So
that
basically
makes sense.
It was a question of pointing. So it's like a bit of software that you write, and you actually point it at the where the files are located.
Right.
And when people click on it, they start downloading and streaming onto the Roku from that location. So there wasn't a need to set up any extra space or anything like that. It's a fairly easy thing to do. I actually used a template for a standard video player channel. And, it worked. It's basic. You know, you just get the various episodes just in one long line.
Well, sometimes you don't need bells and whistles, you know, as long as it works and does what it's supposed to.
Well, it's the KISS principle. Keep it simple, stupid.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? And actually, the funny thing is with this software, it is a bit pedantic about little things like not putting dots in or slashes in the wrong place. So you've got to be very, very precise about when you make little changes.
Yeah.
But it works okay. And I've really been amazed at the number of new viewers that actually came in. It was literally in the tens of thousands simply because we set up that Roku channel, and or rather I set up the Roku channel. And, I've since handed that over to Tommy to manage, and because he's far more computer literate than I am. But it's been a good initiative, and it's really worked well for us, and it's brought in a lot of new viewers. So I was glad to be able to make that contribution.
Yeah, right. So of course, you're an accountant and has nothing to do with electronics or ham radio or computers. Well, no, I guess computers a little bit maybe, but so how did, was you a child? Does it start off as when you was a kid? Did you come up in, was you the kid that was tearing things apart? Or did you come up later?
Not
you know?
Quite. First of all, my parents had no background in electronics or radio whatsoever, so it didn't come from them. I think you might be alluding slightly to the knack. Now, if I use the words the knack, do you know what I'm referring to?
I don't think so.
Oh, okay. No, let me explain. There's a very famous Dilbert cartoon that you can look at on YouTube, and it's very, very humorous. And I won't spoil it for you. I'll just say to the viewers and yourself out there, go have a look on YouTube. Search for The Knack. It's basically a little short piece of Dilbert which talks about Dilbert's upbringing and how he became an engineer. And I'm sure you'll find that extremely humorous. Anyway, in terms of my own background, though, I was born in Melbourne when I was about 3 months old, went over to Perth with my parents, lived there for 10 years, and then we came back for family reasons back to Melbourne. And when we came back, we lived in a number of different places. We finally wound up... we lived it for a year with my grandmother, and that's significant. I'll explain that in a second. And okay. Then a little later, we ended up in central Victoria. Now, my grandmother, at the time, my grandfather had passed away a couple of years earlier. And my grandfather was, I can't say I know a lot about him, but apparently he actually knew Morse code, I believe, because he actually worked on ships.
Okay.
And he also had a big old shortwave radio, you know, the kinds that are about a meter high or three foot high.
Yeah.
And with, you know, big...
Full of tubes.
What do you call it? Oh, exactly right. Okay, and that was still working. Not and it didn't have an aerial or anything, but I was able to listen to shortwave radio and to some Chinese stations, and that kind of got me started. The main thing though that got me started around the same time though was that my parents bought me a crystal set.
Okay.
That is one that's been produced commercially.
Okay, so you didn't build it yourself. You just got one. No.
Now, this one was a little different. You may have heard of rocket radios, which is a crystal set that's built into a plastic sort of a rocket case. I believe they're still available in the United States. Similar to that, except that it wasn't built as a rocket. If you can imagine a small matchbox-sized plastic case, red, okay, and essentially inside it you've got a little ferrite coil.
Oh, yeah.
Let's see, there was a capacitor, a geranium diode, and then you had a clip coming out of that for attaching to an antenna.
Yep.
And we also had an earphone, crystal earpiece.
Yep.
And also inside the coil was the ferrite rod, and attached to the end of the ferrite rod was a little metal, what would you call it, handle, for want of a better word, that you pulled the coil in and out of, I should say, pulled the ferrite rod in and out of the coil. And that's how you tune the crystal radio.
Exactly.
And I found this fascinating because I found that if I went over to the copper tap, I could hear the stations really, really strongly. And then again, if I attached it to something that wasn't conductive, like wood or whatever, I hear nothing. And so that little bit of experience playing with a crystal set started to give me the beginnings of an interest in radio. The interesting thing about a little crystal radio like this is it doesn't tune neatly within the AM broadcast band.
No.
Now, that is about 530 to 1600 kilohertz
right
here in Australia. But this would, if I pulled the ferrite rod out a little bit further, I found I could actually go up above the AM broadcast band.
Mm-hmm.
And lo and behold, I could actually hear amateur radio operators operating AM on 160 meters.
Exactly.
We had a very interesting, and still do, chap, or rather group of people, operating in the 70s here in Melbourne. And these guys at the time would have been in their young 20s. They're engineering students, also amateur radio operators. And they used to get up to all sorts of shenanigans. and their favourite... They're fairly they got pinged once for one of them got pinged once for playing music over the air.
Uh-oh.
But essentially though they you know, they like to talk politics and a few other subjects that are not, that were really frowned upon, strictly in those days. And it was very, very strict, I should say. We're talking in an environment where rules were applied far more strictly than they are today.
Oh, yeah.
And, so what they did was, because they couldn't talk about, let's say, the Prime Minister,
right,
they thought up words or whatever to substitute.
Code words.
So, yeah, code words. So they had this sort of whole code word thing where they're discussing about, and almost like a language in itself. So they were fascinating to listen to. Well, believe it or not, the main protagonist in that group today, 40 years later, is still doing the same thing, pretty much. He's tamed it, he's but far more tame these days. The other key thing about these guys, though, were they were doing this all cross-band, which is something you don't hear on amateur radio very often.
No.
But I must admit, I do actually love it. And I've actually participated with these guys on occasions. What they do is, what's done now, shall we say, more so than they did in those days, is... let's say about 11 o'clock on a Saturday evening on 160 metres and also on 80 metres,
mm-hmm.
This chap in Melbourne will come up and he's transmitting a full 100 watts on either channel. He's actually using an X, I think, what was it, navigational beacon transmitter, of all things, to do the transmitting. And anyway, he'll come up, and what he'll do is he'll invite amateur radio operators to come up for talkback. And so they come in on either 2 meters or on Skype, and basically you're working crossband. We're listening on 160 meters,
right,
and all the audio is being piped out on 160 meters, and I'm talking with him in the same way, just on Skype, for example,
yeah.
And it all works quite well. And it's really just a net when it's said in the end of when it's said and done at the end of the day.
Right.
But the beauty of working crossband is, a lot of those formalities. Well, you can just identify yourself once every 10 minutes, and you've covered yourself off in terms of the regulations. And I find it's a much better way to talk on radio rather than the staccato half duplex kind of way of I transmit, you transmit, etc.
Right.
So it's a lot of fun. And what this guy also does is he actually has all the recordings going back to the 1970s.
Wow.
And he will, as a test transmission, transmit them.
Dedicated, eh?
It's an understatement. Now, if anybody's interested in actually listening to any of this, what they can do is go to a website called www.crossbandradio.com, and you can actually tune in live. They've actually got a streaming service. Yep, there it is, 160 meter crossband radio. It's almost like a historical site as well. It gives you details of these transmissions, VK3ASC, David is the chap who does it, some old photographs of what they were doing back in the 70s, and recordings of what they did in the 70s, links to YouTube videos. By the way, David, VK3AC, has got some very, very interesting radio-related YouTube videos. So you might want to do a search on VK3AC as well and see some of the stuff that he's done. So anyway, getting back to my interest in radio, that kind of got me started.
Yeah.
Now, when I ended up in central Victoria, I was in a very isolated region. Going to school was like an hour bus trip every day. So living away from town and not having many friends apart from at school, there wasn't a lot to do. And I forget how I got it, but I got interested in shortwave radio, and my parents were kind enough to buy me a communications receiver. And I think, I had a couple of them, but I had a realistic DX302. And so at that stage, I did a lot of shortwave radio listening,
right,
and also TV DXing, because I found that I could, you know, move my TV antenna around, or add a TV antenna around, which I made rotatable. And, you know, I was picking up TV from Auckland and from other places as well.
Oh, yeah, that's
so
interesting.
Moving on from there, I finished high school, was unemployed for a couple of years, but eventually got a job working in the city. And I thought, well, I'd heard these amateurs on the radio many, many times. I thought, well, one day I wouldn't mind getting my amateur license. And so now that I was living in the city, I actually went to the Northeast Radio Group, the NERG as it's known, and I took some lessons with them. And I sat for the base grade license at the time, and I thought, well, I might as well have a go at the full call license at the same time.
Yeah.
And I passed it, okay, but cool. Whilst I had the full call theory and passed the novice theory and the novice Morse code, I wasn't quite up yet at the level of the what we call the 10 words per minute that you needed to get the full license. So I ended up with a combined license, right?
Right.
And now at this stage, I still have no radios, but what I did have was my communications receiver, and I also got started at that time in packet radio. And so I had if you can imagine, I'm living in a flat, and I've got a 2-meter transmitter of some kind from somewhere. And also I got a cheap, somebody had made it, I think a J-pole, an aluminium J-pole with a bit of coax attached. And so I, after a bit of mucking around, and I just started to get interested in computing at that stage, I did a little bit of computing at school, I was able to get packet up and running, which was amazing. Honestly, to be able to connect to somebody and send and receive text messages was just amazing thing to do. So I progressed on from there, a few years later, I got married and bought a house out here in Boronia, in eastern Melbourne, and probably for the next, I don't know, 10 or so years, I played a little bit around with various bits of amateur radio, and also got involved with amateur TV. Now, we have an amateur TV repeater here in Melbourne, VK3RTV, and for many years it was an analog TV repeater.
Yeah.
And I'd seen the transmissions many times, and I was able to receive, because I live very close to Mount Daniel, I was able to receive the transmissions pretty easily. And so I got in contact with one of the amateurs, Peter VK3BFG, and he helped me put together my own analog TV transmitter.
Oh.
And so that got me involved with the amateur television, and that leads in nicely then to the point where, well, I'm looking around for content to transmit, and that's how we get into my involvement in amateur logic. So you can see a steady progression over time of different interests in radio building up to the point where one day an opportunity arises for me to actually use those interests and actually put that on a video somewhere.
That's the backstory. So that's how it
came about. It's a long backstory.
There's lots
of things on the side as well. At the same time that I was living down here in Boronia and playing with the amateur TV and such, I was also studying French and later Dutch, and which I'm still studying today. And I wanted to, improve my language skills, and so I looked into satellite television, because there are a few satellite TV channels you can receive in this region of the world, and I ended up getting myself a 1.6-metre dish, which was delivered quite hilariously. I ordered it. It was delivered. Next thing I know, this guy pulls up in a Volvo station wagon and with the dish on his roof rack turned upside down.
So it was assembled. At least the reflector was assembled then, huh? Is this a solid? Reflector?
This is a solid. A 1.6-meter solid.
Okay.
Turned like a cup upside down on his roof rack. And that blew me away. So, but it was one that you can – it's not one you put up in the air. It's one that has like a stand underneath it. Yeah. So in other words, you just sit it on the ground, and then you can actually adjust the, I think it's the azimuth, the height or the angle that the dish is at.
Right.
And then you just physically move the whole assembly around left and right to point it in the particular direction, northeast, southwest, that you want it to be. So that got me involved with satellite television, which I understand you have an interest in as well. And I've also got at the moment I've got a KU band dish set up, which is receiving BVN, the best of Netherlands and Vlaams, which is Flemish and Dutch television, which I receive very, very well down here. So that's another area of radio that I've played with on the side. I've also actually done a little bit in the last 10 years or so, connecting into a local wireless network. What happened was we've got a group called the Melbourne Wireless Group who set up a series of 2.4 gigahertz data wireless links, just the same sort of equipment that you use with your router,
yeah,
and perhaps some Yagi antennas. And they set up a network that's it is separate from the internet, although it does have an internet connection.
Right.
And it basically enables me to connect to somebody on the other side of the city wirelessly through the network.
Right.
And transmit or transfer files at broadband speeds. And it's totally free. So it's a quite amazing little network. Now, it does actually have internet, free internet access on it as well.
Right.
That's kindly donated by one of the people that is a participant in the whole thing. It has a small number of users, between 100 and 200 nodes scattered all across the city. So that's quite an interesting little thing that they put together. And I was able to connect wirelessly into that over a 3-mile distance from here to the top of Mount Dandenong. And then there's like a node up there that connects to various other nodes around eastern Melbourne.
Wow, now are you still messing with that? Is that how you're using the internet now, or do you have something different?
No. I have a broadband connection for internet,
this is the hobby.
Well, it's a toy, if I can put it in those terms. I really don't have a use to transfer files around that particular network. I just sort of connected to it to see, well, could I do it, and right, what was there? And what I found was, in addition to all these various repositories of files of one kind or another, mostly radio-related or computer-related.
Yeah.
But in addition, somebody has actually set up on the top of Mount Dandenong, which is about, 800, 900 metres high,
right,
and it's quite a steep mountain. On the top of it, somebody's put up if you can imagine, like a web camera, slightly better quality, but you can actually remotely operate it. So, wirelessly. So I can actually wow, connect to it and go, all right, I want to zoom in on, yeah, you know, Ringwood. And so I zoom in on Ringwood and I can see the shopping center and things like that.
Oh, wow.
It's quite an interesting little toy. Now, you can't do that from the internet. You can't connect into the internet. You actually have to connect wirelessly into this network to be able to operate that. Mm, yeah. So, you know, so in general, I'm not really purely an amateur radio operator. I've got a much far more broader interest in radio, electronics and computing than that. I think that probably comes through in the kinds of projects that I put together on Amateur Logic.
Our listeners out there, 800 meters, that's what, 2,600 feet maybe, something like that. Just to give everybody an idea.
Oh, sorry. It's about 3 foot a meter, 3 and a bit, so just triple it. Yep. So, so just to give you an idea of the topography of Melbourne, first of all, Melbourne is essentially flat, okay? I live 30 miles approximately due east of that, of Melbourne itself. And then what happens is you come to almost like a chain of mountains, which is Mount Dandenong, or called the Dandenongs, and that's quite a steep climb. So you go very, very quickly straight up, and on the top of that is where we have all our TV towers. And in some videos, you might have seen the Dandenongs in the background. When you get up the top there, it's generally a couple of degrees cooler than the rest of Melbourne, and you've got some very nice views, some beautiful old rainforest, and some lovely English tea rooms and the like. So it's a very, very pleasant place to go to on a weekend.
So there's a lot of tourists go up there and that, or is that just more for locals?
Oh, absolutely. It's a major tourist destination in Victoria. You see a lot of tourist buses actually go up there on weekends, you know, just or even during the week. There's a place called Sky High, which is very famous back in the 70s, and this is how I came across it, because what would happen, I was part of the 70s CBs boom, CB oh, boom. Yeah. When I for about a year or two, when I lived in Melbourne, in a place called Preston, I was a pirate at about 11, 12 years of age, and I had an AM 40 channel radio, mm-hmm. and always keen to see how far can I get out with it.
Yep.
I always envy those people with their single sideband radios that could actually talk internationally.
Oh yeah.
But the best I think I did was about 30 miles with the setup that I had, which was just a helical whip and a radio.
Yeah.
And I was putting out about 5 watts. But I'd hear all these operators operating from Sky High. And what it was, they were mobile. They drive up to what was a circular restaurant, circularly or cake-shaped restaurant. And in the front of it was a car park. There's a little bit of a tourist shop there as well. And people would drive up there with their CBs, and they get really tremendous range because they're up so high.
Oh yeah,
and so that's where I first heard about Sky High, and been up there quite a number of times since. And I always like to go up there for a coffee on a nice day, and you get a beautiful view. You can see right across to Port Phillip Bay and across to Melbourne, and it's just something about being up where you can just see for a really long distance. And you know, of course, the radio range up there is tremendous as well.
Yeah, yeah, similar to me. I started off with, before I, you know, knew anything about amateur radio. There was some buddies that was mm-hmm. into CB and stuff, and then I was in junior high school and stuff, and they was like, hey, you know, I got CBs. And then as it went on, we get in old enough to get our license, and hey man, I got my CB in my car. So I talked my parents into buying me a CB, and I was doing the same thing. And there's a mountain around here, it's like that goes up pretty high, and you could drive up to it. Now it's easier to get to. Before, you really pretty much had a four-wheel drive. But somebody had put up a antenna up there on top of one of the towers mm-hmm. and dropped a coax all the way down, and there was a coax just laying there. All you had to do is pull your vehicle up, undo, you know, your coax from your mobile antenna and screw into that, and then you could, oh, boy, I'm talking big now. You know, and that was, I don't know who did that, but, you know, for a long time you could do that, and of course that's not there anymore. But now you mentioned that go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was going to say just a point that I would make about having been through the CB boom and also through the internet boom subsequently. If you think about it and think about your experiences back when you had a CB back in the 70s or early 80s, I don't know what period quite you're referring to. For me, it was the late 70s. If you think about it, the real attraction to CB was not the actual technology itself. It was that ability to talk with your friends or people in your local area and be able to communicate with them, as simple as that, without having to incur telephone charges and the like.
Yeah.
Now, subsequently, you're seeing in the 2000s and now, what you've seen is the growth of Skype, of chat rooms, mm-hmm. of similar things. The technology is different, but fundamentally, the ability to communicate with other people, whether they're in your own area or whatever, is the same. And I think that there's a similarity between what we saw in the 70s and what we're seeing now, is that people wanted to communicate. The trouble with CB, though, was there were limitations about its range.
Mm-hmm.
There's a bit some cost issues, but also there were you had problems with idiots getting on board and spoiling it for everybody else.
Yeah.
Now,
same thing happened over here too. A lot of idiots got on and just, you know, turned people away from CB.
And of course, CB it's a bit like drive-in theaters, which is another passion of mine. It began to get a bit of a reputation, I think, and that turned people off.
Yeah, exactly.
So, a number of people went to UHF-CB here in Melbourne, and that sort of has grown over the years. But, I think people want to communicate, and now we've got the internet, and that's just like you and I are talking at the moment.
Yeah.
That's now a way for people to talk with each other, and that's a good thing. The other good thing is that, of course, it costs very, very little, and it's international, so I can talk with people all around the world, only generally speaking, good things come out of that.
Yeah, there's still something me about radio, though. I still, like I was telling George last week on the show, it's, you know, the IP stuff and, Skype or Yahoo Chat or any of these other chats. And I like it, you know, because we used to my Echo Link, and I messed with Echo Link some, but didn't really get a big interest in it myself, because if I want to, you know, do somebody, call up and talk to them, you know, over the computer, I can just use Skype or whatever, you know, it's the same thing, really. And if I want to, I can sign my call sign, you know, but, so I really, you know, I really like to, I still like to get on the HF and the key down and hear, you know, VK3PB and say, oh, this guy's in Australia. I'm actually picking up through, you know, through the airwaves instead of, you know, it's kind of like cheating in a way when you go through the internet, but, nothing against it. I still like to do it, but I'm just saying I still like that thrill of making that contact, you know, through the radio.
Well, yes. I think I like, from a technological point of view, I like being able to, how do I put this, to extend my horizons to do something that I haven't done before.
Oh, yeah.
Or to reach that a little bit further in the communication than I have been able to do before. A classic example of that is like with my packet radio when I was living in a flat was, you know, that was something I hadn't been able to do before,
yeah.
And it was a real thrill for me just to come to make that first connection to somebody who was 20 miles away, yeah. And to fairly reliably be able to send and receive text from them. That just blew my mind. Subsequently, by the way, around probably about 10 years ago, I also was doing a little bit of packet radio here in Boronia, okay, as part of my amateur radio activities. And for the first time, I connected to the International Space Station using packet radio.
I did the same thing.
And subsequently got a QSL card, as you would have as well,
yep.
You know, with all the Russian characters and everything on it, saying, yep, you've connected. Oh, sorry, actually, no, let me correct myself. Sorry. Let me go back one step. There were two things that happened, actually, about 10 years ago. It wasn't the International Space Station I connected to. It was the Mir Space Station. I should have corrected myself there. There were two things that happened. One was me actually connecting to the onboard packet radio station, and the second thing was hearing the Australian astronaut, Andy Thomas, as he was coming over Melbourne, actually talking in real time with one of the amateur radio operators down here on 2 meters, and just listening to that happening live was just amazing.
Right.
So those two things for me were really amazing memories. And, of course, I've got the QSL card from the Mir Space Station. Subsequently, I've connected on packet radio to the International Space Station. And I think if you go to episode 25 of Amateur Logic, I covered that there. And that too was quite an amazing experience, and I've got the QSL card back from that. Now, the one thing I was thinking of doing this weekend, if I have the time, apparently I read that there's I think it's a Chinese satellite, I might be wrong about that, that's been launched. It's an amateur radio satellite that is going around the moon and is actually transmitting on 2 meters, JT65.
Is this the one that they're going to eventually put up in geosynchronous orbit, or is this a different one?
I don't know. I'm not sure. I've only just gotten the scant details about it. In fact, if I just very quickly open up my email, I might be able to find the reference. It was actually in a here we go.
They're supposed to be sending one up. I won't be able to get it over here. It'd be out of my footprint. It'd be out of the United States and North America. But they're going to actually, and I've talked about this for years, you know, but they're actually going to put up one geosynchronous.
The page is just loading up at the moment. This was in a Wireless Institute broadcast, which has just been come on recently. Amateur radio payload circles the moon. Says the launch today was a lunar mission craft from China, has a payload including amateur radio transmitting on 145 990 megahertz using the JT65B mode and developed by Luxspace in Luxembourg. Conflicting reports have the spacecraft engaged in a slingshot around the moon and re-entry, while others say that it's not the case, with it being only a flyby mission. Whatever the case, if it's up there transmitting on 2 meters and transmitting JT65, I reckon it would be a really cool thing to grab my beam pointed at the moon and try and receive that signal.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm talking about, that idea of doing something you haven't done before, you know, the idea of being able to receive a signal from even further away than you've received previously has a certain attraction to me. And I maybe, you know, if I can record it, maybe I maybe even be able to get a special QSL card or something out of it. So it's really quite an interesting thing or experiment that they're trying, and I played with JT65, and I can certainly easily receive JT65 transmissions at low power from all around the world.
Oh, yeah.
So it shouldn't be, line of sight to the moon should be fairly easy, I imagine.
Yeah, it should be, you think. And, that's something I want to read more about, and then I'm going to have to read more about that other one too, because I know somewhere somebody's sending up a satellite on the other half the world from me that's supposedly going to be, I don't know if they've got it yet, if they're still in planning stages. I've seen some little video. I think over here the ARRL had sent something out in the email, and I was like, oh, so they're finally, somebody's going to finally get one, because I thought for years they should put up one. But, you know, of course it'll be so covered up. You know, you imagine a local repeater there, but if you get one up in space that's covering several countries, and, you know, it's going really going to be. But getting back to that, we're getting a little close on time here. Let's get back on your involvement with how is the, you know, because we're Satellite Nation, you know, is a lot about, you know, we kind of started off from free to air and all that stuff, messing with C-band dishes and stuff. How is the television over there in Australia compared to how it is over here?
It's the same rubbish, basically. our programming is predominantly a mixture of British and American programming. So we get all the same shows that you guys do, Game of Thrones, etc. Although I think Game of Thrones might be just coming in, from what I've heard. Apparently it's very famous over in the US. We have one cable TV provider who, in my opinion, you know, has charged some fairly hefty fees, but is starting to get a bit cheaper because there's talk of Netflix coming into Australia next year. And to basically explain, we've got about, three commercial networks and two government networks, one of which is devoted to ethnic programming. And each of those networks will have, say, three channels. And for the commercial networks, one of those channels typically is a shopping channel, and one's a general interest, or, you know, like new TV productions and or first-rate TV productions, and the second channel tends to be repeats from channels from 20 or 30 programs from 20 or 30 years ago. So, but a lot of people are turning off free-to-air TV. They still watch it for the sport and maybe the odd show, but a lot of people are just finding there's just so much rubbish on there that they can go to the internet and get a much wider range and better quality. Now, we also, as I said, have one cable TV provider who provides up to, I think it's 300 channels. It's ridiculous, most of which you don't watch.
Right, okay. Exactly.
And also, as well as that, as I mentioned, we've got satellite TV, and there's probably 20 to 30 satellites in our region, and of which, say, 20 you would be able to receive here in Australia. Mostly ethnic channels, a couple of English-speaking news channels like RT, I think CNN, BBC World Service. You can receive, I think, most of those down here. And as I said, the ethnic channels, obviously, and a number of religious broadcasters as well. So you've got a number of different television options, but as I say, I wouldn't. The free-to-air TV has declined in quality, in my view. Mind you, the stuff still coming out of Britain is not bad. That tends to be a pretty good quality from the BBC, which has got a good reputation for TV programming.
So now all that on satellite, is that, Is that free, you know, still free to air if you want to watch it, or do you have to pay for it? Or is the only paid one through the cable system, or is there paid through satellite also?
Well, the pay TV is delivered typically through, primarily through broadband, okay? Through cable, I should say.
Right.
So we have two sets of cables running past my house. So I've got, I think either through Optus or through Telstra, I can get the same pay TV service, which is Foxtel. There are a number of smaller pay TV providers, but they provide nowhere near the quality or the range of channels. Now, for those people that don't have cable, like living out in country Victoria, for example, they will typically have a KU band dish and their pay TV, which is still quite a number of channels, but the digital bouquets are actually delivered via satellite, so encrypted satellite. Right. So when you actually go on to, you're shooting around and you're looking at the satellite, each satellite will typically have a mixture of encrypted and non-encrypted transmissions.
Yeah.
So, for example, I know on one satellite here in Australia, I can find the whole Foxtel bouquet. And I can also find one channel which is in the clear, which is actually a satellite community television, which is actually a community TV station, but is actually transmitted via satellite across Australia. Funny concept, but and that has a number of ethnic broadcasts or ethnic programs put on it. I should point out, Melbourne and Australia is very ethnic and very European. So we have large populations of people from Italy, Greece, Macedonia, Southern Europe, but also the Netherlands, Germany, England. And a number of those are relatively recent arrivals, hence the need for a fifth network that actually provides some ethnic programming. We also have quite a number of Chinese migrants in recent times, or people from Malaysia, but predominantly Chinese background immigrants. And so we have various ways of seeing Chinese programming. For example, on satellite TV, there's 20-plus Chinese channels that are free to air.
Is there any C-band still being used over there?
Oh, yeah, plenty of C-band and also plenty of KU-band. It's probably 50-50. Pretty much. I actually prefer the C-band because it's reliable. It doesn't matter about the weather. You'll get a better reception all round.
Oh, yeah. That's what I like about C-band better here, too. It's and the way over in the U.S., you know, we don't have as many free-to-air channels. We got a lot more scrambled channels. I really want you to pay for. But there's more on C-band, and that's what I like about it. I can find something to watch on C-band, and it could come a storm, unless it's not, you know, any tornado or something where it's blowing the dish around. You know, you'll still get the signal.
Yeah, I have a bit of satellite envy, if I can put it in those terms, because you guys have NASA TV via satellite in the clear. And that's something I wish we had here in Australia, simply because I can certainly receive it, and I like to watch things like the rocket launches and that. And I sort of hope they blow up, because it always looks really, really good.
It's like watching a car race, you know, you're waiting for that wreck to happen,
It's not that I particularly want anybody to be killed or hurt or anything like that, but the freight rockets, etc., you know, it's always good once in a while to see one of them blow up. And I always love it when I see NASA and the commentators say, "Oh, we've had an anomaly."
Yeah.
It's so understated.
Oh, yeah. It's just an anomaly.
And they always say, you know, if you ever watch the rocket launches, they always say, this nominal, you know.
Yeah.
And and then they come up with, you know, if it blows up, they go, "Oh, we've had an anomaly." And then if you saw I think it was last week, they've just had, Orbital have had which is a private contractor, of course, have had a rocket blow up.
Yeah.
They didn't do the nominal like NASA do. And B, when it blew up, they just went to silence. They went, "Oh." I think eventually they admitted, "Oh, we've got a problem here."
Yeah.
But, I also like watching the SpaceX launches. They've got a slightly different way of commenting them as well. I don't like seeing anybody hurt in a rocket accident, but you know, seeing the occasional freight rocket blow up is good value.
Oh, yeah. Let's briefly, we talked off air about programming and stuff, and I was, I think it was at the last Amateur Logic, where you, or maybe it was the one before, I think it was the last one, he was talking about, you're working on this project for a balloon that you're going to send around, and so how did you get into programming, how did you get into doing that?
Okay, programming, well, I studied a little bit of BASIC in about 1982 when I was at high school. And I did a little bit of assembler just in my own time, just learning a little bit about the basic concepts, but didn't really have much of an opportunity to do any programming until a much, much, much later stage. Now, it's only literally in the last couple of years that I've done any. And what I did was I wanted to learn Python, which was let me put it this way. Every time I looked at a language like C or Visual Basics, it just looked like gobbledygook to me.
Yeah.
And I thought I tried to get into it, but I just couldn't understand. It was just too foreign to me, if I can put it in those terms. But when I looked at Python, I thought, gee, this looks a lot like BASIC. It's like BASIC on steroids. Runs a lot faster.
Yeah, no line numbers.
And but it still was a structured language and quite powerful, and you could get add-on libraries and things like that. And, of course, you could run it on the Raspberry Pi. So I thought, well, I'd like to learn this. And then I heard about that MIT were offering some of their units online for free, and you could go and do like a 6-month course in a subject at the online using their special software, which sort of does all the marking of tests and things like that.
Yeah.
And you could actually learn Python in a subject called 600X Introduction to Computer Science and Programming. And the attraction for me also was that I wanted – now, this is at the same standard. It's the same coursework as they do at the university in-house with their own students normally. So I thought, well, I always wanted – I had studied at universities here in Australia, and I thought, well, could I cut it at, you know, one of the world's top universities? So I enrolled for the subject, worked really hard, and actually wound up getting an A, which was 83%. And in the course of that, I learned to program in Python.
Right.
And so, you know, I've got the certificate sitting up on my wall here, which I'm very proud of, and just given me more than anything, and it just gave me a lot of self-confidence and thought, well, if I can do that, you know, I can really cut it in a whole lot of other areas. So I learned Python. And you might have, on our show, you might have also seen, mentioned that, NASA had a thing where you could actually look at, they set up a website where you could look at, images from the SOHO spacecraft, which is a spacecraft that is looking directly at the sun, but it blocks out the light of the sun's disk itself and looks so you can actually see the area immediately around the sun.
I've heard about that.
And there are these sun-grazing comets that come in very close to the sun, and basically they gave people an opportunity to discover a comet. So what I ended up doing was writing a program that took these images and actually hunted and found comets. And so that was quite a good practical application of those skills that I actually developed. Now, quite separately to that, I actually about a year ago actually discovered my first comet. I don't know whether that's been recorded and they've given the designation.
Right.
But, you know, it discovered by Peter Barrett, you know. So that was a big thing for me. But now the computer program can actually take the images and analyze them and, well, to a reasonable degree, pick out where what it thinks is a comet, and then I can come along and have a closer look at it. It has a few false hits, but it's not bad. I'm pretty impressed with what it was able to do at the end of the day. Essentially, it's looking for, based on time, a dot or a white dot that isn't, shall we say, something in the background like a star that moves. That moves at a set pace in a straight line over a period of time. So we're looking for, let's say, you've got four images that are all 12 minutes apart. What you're looking for is something that moves in the same amount of distance in the X and Y coordinates, each image and moves in a straight line. And so that's what I did. I wrote a program to kind of find that and sift out all the other stuff like the stars that remain static in the one place. And, yeah, it picks them out. So that was another fun little hobby to do on the side, but also a good application for Python. And I hope in the future to actually use those Python skills to, you know, use a or to develop some kind of application for the Raspberry Pi. At the same time, with respect to the Balloon project, I've started to also get into Arduinos, which unfortunately are programmed in C, but I've been able to muddle together a number of libraries and sufficiently. What's happened is we've actually got a guy called Andy here in Melbourne who's an amateur radio operator.
Yeah.
And every couple of weeks he releases a balloon with a little radio transmitter, which is transmitting GPS coordinates on the balloon. And we track it as it works its way up the east coast of Melbourne, east coast of Australia, or across to New Zealand, or in various directions. And so that's kind of inspired me to want to do the same. I want to build a very light payload, less than 50 grams, that will have a little computer and a GPS and a little transmitter. And so that's what I did in the or have started to do in the latest Aminology. The biggest problem is power consumption. A couple of batteries will go flat within 12 hours. Yeah. I really want to extend this out over a couple of days.
Right.
So to do that, I need to be able to switch my GPS and also my AD9850, which is effectively my radio transmitter, switch that off when I'm not using them so that the power is conserved.
Yeah.
And then also put the Arduino into sleep mode so that it is not using power as well. So by doing that, I can make the batteries last a lot longer and therefore track the balloon for a much longer period of time.
Well, I can't wait to see your project on that and see the rest of it. But unfortunately here, we're just about out of time. So I appreciate you being on the show and definitely will bring you back in. You got plenty of stuff to have an interesting life and maybe we'll come back into like programming or something or we'll have more time to talk about different things like that. But I've been... chatting with you there, Peter, and having you on the show.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure, Michael, and, you know, all I've done is rabbit along about a lot of things that interest me, but that's really just what I do on Aminologic most of the time is just sort of put out what I'm doing in a radio-related field at any one point in time and just put it out there for people to have a look at and discuss, and I don't try to specially produce anything for people. I just really just what you see is what you get. That's true of Tommy and George as well. Off air, we're exactly the same as we are on air, and I think you've probably already picked that up by chatting with me off air a little bit earlier.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so yeah, look, and thanks to, just on behalf of Aminologic and also on behalf of the amateurs out there, thanks for what you do as well. It's great to have other people producing content that you know people can listen to.
Yeah, appreciate it. And anybody wants to go and watch Peter and some of his projects and some things he does, you can head over to amateurlogic.tv with George and Tommy. And I got to get Tommy on the show and catch him there. Mm-hmm. So that'll be it for tonight, folks. Catch you next week on another edition of Satellite Nation.
Yep, 73s, everyone.
Thanks to all that tuned in tonight. Join Satellite Guys Michael and Brian next Wednesday for another informative episode of Satellite Nation. And don't forget to like our page at facebook.com/Satellite Nation Radio. Until next week, good night.